because you're jumping back into the gap. I'll let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebounding.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Today, I'm excited to welcome Paul Hewitt to the podcast. Coach Hewitt's had tremendous success. 18 years as an NCAA head coach and made a big impact on the game in so many ways. And now he's a scout for the Los Angeles Clippers and so many different places, coach, we can go to be able to talk about the game. And just first off, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Chris. I look forward to our conversation today.
Well, coach, I've had a chance to hear you speak a few times. And yeah, I think I've said this to you a little bit personally, but I've just so enjoyed hearing you speak about the game. And I don't think there's too many people that are speaking as effectively and eloquently about the game of basketball and the state of basketball. And we're going to get into that a little bit. But I want to start because I read something that I thought was an incredible quote that I think captures the type of person you are. But you guys had tremendous success 2004 when you went to the Final Four, lost in the national final. We won't talk about that to UConn, but tremendous. I remember that semifinal. It was a buzzer beater, if I remember right.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, Will Bynum made a shot to beat Oklahoma State to send us to the finals.
Yeah, tremendous. And you talked about, in retrospect, about that team, and you said something to the effect that it makes sense that that team had success because the kids that were on that team are now doing well in life. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, to do anything of significance in such a competitive environment as the NCAA and making it all the way to the championship game, you've got to have a group of people and character that will sacrifice to one another, who are all about preparing for the next competition. And it takes a certain amount of sacrifice and discipline, and all those things are what we look for, you know, in young people, that you know that those characteristics suggest they're going to be successful. So when I look back on that team, I look at a Jarrett Jack who's continuing to play in the NBA, even though when he came into Georgia Tech, he was considered one of the lower ranked point guards that came into the ACC that year. He was ranked behind Sean Dockery, who went to Duke, John Gilchrist, who went to Maryland, and Raymond Felton, who went to North Carolina, and then Will Bynum, and even guys like Ishmael Muhammad. Will has played in the NBA and overseas for years, but Ishmael Muhammad is now an executive at an executive search firm here in the Atlanta area. Marvin Lewis is second in command at Georgia Tech in the athletic department. And I could go on. I mean, Luke Shencher went on to play pro ball for a long time. He's back over in Australia. He's got some business interests over there. So it's not a surprise when I look at these guys. And not only are they successful in their professional lives, but I look at, you know, their husbands and their fathers, and they're just doing some really remarkable things in their own homes and in their communities. And again, so when I look back on that team and I think back of all the great teams I've been a chance to be associated with, whether it's at Villanova when we won the Big East Championship, all those kids have gone on to be successful. And I don't know if it's what came first, chicken or the egg, but I do know that their character had a lot to do with our team's success, and the character they showed has continued to serve them well as they moved on.
Well, you mentioned Jarrett Jack, and I had someone once tell me that he's the most surprisingly successful NBA player in history. He meant that as a compliment in the sense that somehow it seemed like every year that he wasn't going to be good enough, but not only always good enough, but he was always doing things the right way that you always wanted him to be a part of your team. And could there be a better compliment for a player?
You're exactly right. Because even when we signed him, I thought he'd be a very good college player. But to tell me that Jarrett was going to be playing in the NBA, here it is, potentially start of his 14th season, you would have taken all my money on that bet. And I knew he was playing the NBA, but the fact that he's here now, you know, with the New Orleans Pelicans and looking, staring at a 14th season says an awful lot about him, his intelligence, his work ethic, all the things that organizations look for, especially when you look at that point guard position.
Well, and it brings up a nice segue to something that I wanted to ask you about, because being now a scout and obviously having success at so many levels where clearly you were recruiting high school players, you were dealing with college players, you were scouting against college players, and now you're in the NBA focusing on the potential of a future NBA player. And it's obvious talent, effort, work ethic, those are things that make players successful. But can you talk about some of the things that maybe we don't think about enough as coaches or as people that follow the game about what makes a player successful?
Chris, I think the trend in the NBA, and certainly with us with the Los Angeles Clippers, is to really dig deep and try to find out exactly who these guys are. Like, what kind of people are they? What kind of family members are they? What kind of teammates are they? I think the talent, it's not easy to recognize the talent that's translatable to the NBA, but it's certainly easier to find the talent than it is to find out the character. And what we have decided to do with the rebuild or the remake, if you will, of the LA Clippers is, you know, we don't have the guys that they're named superstars that we had the last few years. We've decided, listen, we're going to draft kids that are high in character, who love the game, who are going to be great teammates, and see where it takes us. And so far, so good. Last year, by anybody's estimation, our basketball team overachieved. And this year, we've looked really good in training camp. And really, one of the guys who's led the charge this year, the Canadian, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And if you looked at Shai last year, this time, no one projected he would be an NBA player, much less a lottery pick. But because of his work ethic, because of his character, certainly he's got physical talent and his basketball talent has improved. He put himself where he ended up being the 11th pick overall in the draft. We traded for him. Obviously, we swapped our 12th pick with the Charlotte Hornets for the 11th pick to get Shai. And that has become the formula that Lawrence Frank, Steve Ballmer, Jerry West, and Doc Rivers have all really, you know, honed in on. It's like, listen, we can develop talent. We're coaches. We're going to get guys in the gym and work on things. We as scouts can go out and recognize the high-end talent. But what's the difference in the guy that has great talent and translates into being having a great career and the guy that has great talent but just never seems to quite make it? And so we're really working hard on the background stuff. Who these guys are has become a much, much bigger part of the equation than just watching who can make a shot and who can defend the ball.
And digging deeper for what you say there, is that looking at family? Is that looking at friends? Is that doing extensive interviews? What is digging deeper? What does that mean?
It definitely means looking at friends, especially, you know, what does a young man like to do off the court? I mean, and again, it's not about passing judgment on people. It's about trying to figure out who are the best players out there. And when you look at the best players out there, the ones that are constantly vying for championships, the one thing they all have is a tremendous love for the game. Even if, you know, you go back to a Michael Jordan, a Bill Russell, a Larry Bird, a Magic Johnson, all those guys had an unbelievable love for the game. They worked on their craft. They were extremely competitive people. They looked at what, you know, the stories are legendary of how Magic Johnson motivated Larry Bird and Larry Bird motivated Magic Johnson. And so we're trying to find those guys that have that similar DNA of those great players. They may not have the physical talent, say like a Jordan, but if they have that DNA, there's a place for them on a winning roster. And so it does come down to who they hang out with. Families are families, you know, you can't choose your family, but there are choices that kids make that kind of give you some insight to, well, how much are they willing to sacrifice and how hard are they willing to work in order to achieve the goal that they all say they want, probably from their 10 years old on up or whenever they started playing the game of basketball.
Well, and that's great. And I think a lot of this stuff applies to like all levels. If we're talking about evaluating from JV to varsity, from varsity to college or whatever it may be, but let's talk specifically about, you get the opportunity to go watch future prospects in practice. What are some of the things that you see in practice that as a coach, I could go to my team and say, listen, you know, these are some of the things that an NBA scout or NBA personnel director would look at and say, hey, this makes me more interested in this player. Look, you're only looking at players that have a certain amount of talent relative to the NBA, but there are separators. So what are some of those things in practice specifically that separate a player?
That's a great question. I had a coach at a Power Five conference text me the other day with the very same question. And the number one thing I thought of was communication. I always told myself, communication is king. And by that, I mean, if a guy is engaged in practice, talking to a guy during the stretching, encouraging his teammate during the drill, communicating when they're on a defensive possession, talking a guy through an offensive possession, that tells me so much about that young man. It tells me, number one, how engaged that person is in that possession or that task that's going on at that point. Number two, it tells me how enthusiastic that person is about the goal that the team has set out. And number three, it really tells me just how intelligent they are. Because if you have a guy, let's say like a Jarrett Jack, I'll tell you a funny story. He's playing for the Portland Trailblazers and it was during the preseason. And I'm getting ready to go on a recruiting trip because I was still coaching at Georgia Tech at the time. And I had NBA TV on and they were doing their real training camp thing. and I'm getting packing my stuff up, and I had it on in the background, and I hear this voice, and I stop and I look at the TV. I was like, man, that voice sounds so familiar. And sure enough, it was Jared Jack in a practice with the Portland Trailblazers, and he was calling my defensive communication and helping guys run through the offense. So that says to me, that guy's really intelligent player. He's really like, he has studied, he understands what the coaches want. So communication is something that's really, really important. I mean, all the other stuff are measurable. You know, vertical leaps are measurable. Shooting percentages are measurable. But when a guy is talking and communicating and encouraging teammates, I went to a practice yesterday and I saw a young man who's out with an injury. He's a freshman. He has a knee injury. And he caught my eye. He didn't shoot a ball. He didn't make a defensive play. But he was just on the sideline encouraging his teammates. And here's a guy that might be out for the whole year redshirting, but is a 6'10 freshman with a great body. And the thing that struck me was, man, this guy is engaged in this practice as if he's out here playing, getting ready to start a game tomorrow, really encouraging teammates. So communication, chatter, talk, encouragement of teammates, that's something that really catches my eye when I go out to these practices.
That's something to bring back to all of our teams and to tell them that that's something that someone in your position would notice. And that's clearly something that coaches want within practice, but getting that is much more difficult than just saying it. They have to want to do it, and they have to do it. So that's great. Coach, what about
the great ones do? Chris, I'll tell you what, I'll go back to the point. The great ones do. Very few great players I've noticed who aren't communicators in practice. And sometimes you may not like the communication they're given. I mean, the stories are legendary about how hard Michael Jordan was on his teammates and how Kobe could be tough on his teammates. But at the end of the day, there's a level of care that they display and a level of push that they get, you know, try to demand or try to encourage your teammates one way or another to reach their limits and reach their potential.
I tell my freshmen, listen, at the beginning of the season, I say, you guys probably don't know what to say yet, but it doesn't matter. Just say something initially, and then you'll figure out what you're supposed to say, but start with talking, and that effort will obviously translate into understanding as well. But what about stuff like running plays? Like, having been exposed to the NBA a lot, you know, clearly the ability to be able to execute plays, whether it be ATOs in the moment or obviously just generally a big playbook, is that something that you can evaluate to watching them within a practice?
You can, but it really, honestly, that comes down to you got to do some digging on that, because you catch them on a day where they're not doing a whole lot. But that's important. But for me personally, maybe a different scout would have a different take on it. But for me, it's harder to figure out if they're actually executing things the right way. Now, I do have friends in the business and I know their stuff. And so if I go there, I'm familiar with it. I can tell if a guy's executing properly or not. But that is very, very important. I tell you what's even becoming more important now, as the NBA becomes more of a free-flowing offensive game, is being able to read situations. Now, that you can see. You can see a guy in a ball screen situation. Does he get off the ball when he sees the hedge? Or does he string it out and throw back to the left guy? You know, what's his decision making like? Is his head up when he comes up? Those things are obvious. But in terms of specific play execution, that really, you get that when you have conversations with the coaching staff or even teammates.
Well, you know, that stuff's up my wheelhouse in terms of decision making. And trying to evaluate that is somewhat tricky, but I think you get a better feel for it, to be honest, in practice than you do in a real game. Just because
Absolutely. You
can kind of see, as you said, how they interact with their teammates, how they make decisions on and off the ball and those different things. So that's great to hear. But I guess the other thing, which I thought is unique in your situation, and you mentioned this, is that you've probably prepared a scout for a lot of these teams, having coached, obviously, very recently against a lot of these different programs and different coaches. And does that give you a unique perspective going into a practice as well, that you do kind of understand what they're doing and what they're trying to do?
Yeah, I do. But, you know, the game is changing so rapidly. The three-point line has changed the game so much, and big men aren't as prevalent. Certainly in the NBA game, you don't see as many big impact in the game as it once was. So you definitely have to stay current. I think it gives me somewhat of an advantage, because I know a lot of the coaches. I've competed against them. I know their mindsets. I know what they're going to demand. But you'd be surprised. Even, you know, I've been out of coaching now since 2015, and in just these 3 years, I've seen some really significant, noticeable changes in coaching styles, just to keep up with the time, so to speak.
Well, and that brings up another point. And sometimes unfairly, the NCAA gets criticized as not adapting fast enough. But really, what it is there's just so many teams that you can't possibly know who's adapting or who's not adapting unless you literally watch every team. But do you find the NCAA is adapting a little bit to the new modern style?
Yeah, I think the coaches are making the necessary adjustments. You know, you see the three-point line becoming more and more a factor, or has become a significant factor. You look at Villanova last year, they basically rode the three-point line all the way to the national championship. There was a time where I didn't think you could depend on making three-pointers for six games to win a national championship. I used to think that back as early as 2003 and 2004. Now, you know, you definitely can do it. If you can't shoot the three, Duke did it a few years ago when they had Justice Winslow and those guys, and certainly they had Jahlil Okafor in the low post, but they rode that three-point line all the way to the national championship. And so I do see it happening in college coaching. I think the coaches on the college level are really good. I don't think they get as much credit as they deserve, but I think they're really good. I think they study and they prepare.
Well, again, I'm always impressed, and I've had an opportunity to be able to watch NBA and NCAA coaches in practice, and that's where you can really tell. I mean, sometimes the game gets messed up by the other team, right? Like, you know, sometimes your kids don't execute as well, or, you know, certainly there's different styles you play better against, et cetera, et cetera. But I've been generally very impressed with the level of coaching that goes on in practices, and no, that's good. And the other question, Coach, that brings up is before and after practice, what are habits of players that you would say, that you would identify, and you could say, a coach could go to their players and say, listen, you know, an NBA scout or a successful college coach sees this and says, wow, that makes me look at this a little bit deeper because this player is doing some things before and after practice that may think he can get better. What are some of those things that you see?
You know, there's nothing earth-shattering. There's nothing new. There's nothing new, big revelations here. It's about coming in. Even in how they, you know, they tie their shoes up, are their shoes tied up? Do they have the proper practice gear on? Where do they start their shooting? Are they coming out just launching three-pointers and talking to their teammates? Are they getting down to work? I mean, it's like anything else. Like, okay, you go to the library with a bunch of friends, you may have a little chat, but when you get there to sit down and study, it's like, okay, you got to close your mind off. Let's not get distracted. Let's work on the things we got to work on. It's the same thing in basketball, okay? Kid comes in the gym. I always notice, you know, what are they working on first? Are they coming in just launching three-pointers, or are they coming in and they have a warm-up routine that involves ball handling, involves shooting in close, involves the basic things that happen in a game, whether it's I see guys that will work on throwing bounce passes off a wall, chest passes off a wall, just to warm their hands up, warm their arms up to get their passing, you know, muscles, I guess, if you will, you know, warmed up. And then after practice, who's going to, you know, grab a coach to get a few more things in based on how they perform that day. If somebody had a little issue shooting the ball from the left corner, okay, am I going to go in there and make sure I take X number of shots or make X number of shots before I walk out of the gym? And then finally, how do they take care of their bodies? Do they stretch? Do they ice down? Are they doing the things necessary? Because the thing about the NBA, I've been saying this ever since I got involved with college basketball, there are a lot of guys that play 40 games in the NBA season, but who can take care of their body well enough, take care of their mind well enough, they can stretch it over 70, 82 games, maybe even 100 games, depending on how far you go in the playoffs. So I look at, okay, who's going to get ice? Who's stretching properly? Because everybody now, I remember when I first became a head coach, that was one of the first things I did, is I started stretching after practice. I'll make sure, because I talked to some physical therapists and they said that's one of the ways to make sure you get the blood out of the muscles to cut down on the swelling and cut down on the tearing that goes on and the rebuilding of the muscle. And so I watch that, who's doing what they have to take care of their body after practice.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And it's some of those player-led moments rather than coach-led moments that would probably give you an indication of how much that player wants to get better. And it's something that I try and teach to youth coaches is that as a youth coach, it's part of our responsibility to teach players how to lead themselves in their development. And maybe this leads to another question is probably...
Let me go to the next. One of the things that opened our eyes to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, I went to see them practice in January. I wasn't the only guy that recognized that this kid's got a chance. But I went to them playing practice in January before they played Texas A&M at home. And I was having a conversation with one of their assistant coaches, Kenny Payne. And I said, who has the best attitude on your team? Like, who comes to work every day? Who does all the right things? And I also asked that question of their trainer, Chris Simmons. And they both said Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And we're talking about a time now where, like, he's kind of like, his name is starting to get some buzz. People are talking about him. But they both said, like, he's the guy that comes in first every day. He's got a smile on his face. He goes to work diligently. And after practice, the trainer's like, oh, yeah, he's in the training room taking care of his body. You know, he goes to train the table, gets his meal before he goes to the library, does everything the right way. And so what that tells me, players like with that type of mindset and that type of attitude, if they have the talent, they're going to be able to sustain themselves to be successful for the long term.
You know, basically being professional and, you know, without being paid, you know, in the NCAA model, being professional. And we'll get into that a little bit later, but that's something that we try and explain to our players already is what that means, being professional. And again, it doesn't just apply to basketball. It applies to future employability, whatever that may be, you know, how you act.
Exactly.
That's a great story and a great connection. Another thing I wanted to ask you about is maybe 20 years ago, you would have seen a lot of pre and post practice one-on-one. You mentioned Michael Jordan and, you know, you hear about those one-on-one games. Is that something that we see nowadays? Do we see players self-organize some one-on-one before and after practice? Or is that something that's gone by the side and more is coach led?
You know, that's a great question. As you were forming the question, I thought about it. I don't see it as much as I used to. I definitely don't see it as much as I used to. I think the game has become, as you talked about, coach led to a detriment probably, and certainly parent led to a detriment. I was on the phone this morning with George Ravlin, who's my mentor in this business. He gave me my biggest break when I went out to the University of Southern California to be a graduate assistant for him in 1989. And he just got back from China where they had a FIBA meeting. And, you know, Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, was there. And Mark Tatum, I'm not sure his title, but he's one of the high-ranking officials in the NBA. And they were talking about the rise of three-on-three basketball internationally and how the U.S. has kind of lagged behind in it. And the thing about the three-on-three, and he said it's why it's really helping the game internationally, is number one, there's no coaching. Number two, there are really no timeouts to speak of. I guess the kids, they've got to coach themselves. And so you've gotten back to the roots of the game. Guys are just learning how to pass, cut, move without the ball, defend on an island, and try to figure it out themselves. And so I think the time that kids can invest in playing one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three, without a coach there, I think we do an awful lot to help them develop how they think about the game, how to stretch their mind about the game without having some coach tell them this is right and that is wrong. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that drew me to you when I watched you speak at Larry Scheid's clinic down at the University of Florida the last 2 years is your training. Because I'm a big individual structure training guy and teaching guys how to play. And I think I told you some of the workouts I did this year, I worked out one of our Exhibit 10 guys, a guy that we brought in training camp, and I employed some of the stuff in terms of trying to, instead of just saying, hey, we're going to take 25 shots from this spot and 25 from that spot, let's mix it up a little bit. You're going to defend to half court and you're going to sprint back and we're going to throw you the ball and you're going to make shots after you've had to do a little defending for like 20 to 15 feet on the court. And so the idea that kids aren't playing as much one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three, is certainly, I think, that has hurt the mind development, the knowledge development of the game. These kids are better athletes. Let's be clear on that. They're better shooters. They're better ball handlers. But sometimes they don't understand the nuances of the game because they're waiting for somebody to tell them what's right and what's wrong, as opposed to discovering on their own, playing one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three.
Wow. That, you just said it, discovering on their own. And that's definitely, that's the goal of FIBA 3-on-3, is that players get to be creative, they get to play the game. And I know at a lot of grassroots level in our country, and I think countries throughout the world that are playing FIBA rules, 3-on-3 is king. Like, there's no 5-on-5 at under 11 or under 14, whatever the ages are in different countries. So, and it's for that reason that there's more opportunities to be able to, you know, put just through self-discovery and develop some creativity and different things like that. And look, no matter what the U.S.
Coach Radler actually suggested to me today, he said if he was the czar of basketball, he might even put in a rule that nobody over the age of 12 could play 5-on-5. They all would have to play 3-on-3. And I said to him, I said, Coach, I said, that's how it was. You know, I got out of high school in 1981. And, you know, in the 70s, we'd go down to the schoolyard. And just so happened that the schoolyard at the end of my block on Westbury, Long Island, only had a half a court. There's no full court. You'd have to go to another side of town to go play full court. So I'd go down there with, you know, three of my friends, four of my friends. We played 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 2-on-2, whatever. And that was the way I learned the game. I mean, obviously, I had a very good high school coach, Martin Reed, and I played for a guy, Bobby Wanzer, a Hall of Famer in college at St. John Fisher College in Rochester, New York. But I learned the game playing 3-on-3 at Powell's Lane Elementary School on a half a court.
A quick interruption to this week's episode to let you know what you're missing if you are not currently a member of BasketballImmersion.com. Basketball Immersion is one-stop shopping for video learning to stimulate your basketball coaching using evidence-based practices. Watch hundreds of videos covering BDT shooting, zero-second skill training, how we teach using small-sided games and a games approach to coaching, as well as team concepts and systems like trail trap, flow offense, two-sided fast break, and much, much more. NCAA, NBA, pro, high school, and youth coaches are amongst the thousands of coaches who are a part of our community. Go to basketballimmersion.com today to stimulate your basketball coaching.
It's so different. And clearly players nowadays have tremendous advantages in terms of, again, the organization of the game, the access to quality training, whether it be sports science or obviously just the rise of the trainer or whatever it may be. In most cases, they just have better access to things that can help them understand how to improve. But ultimately, it still comes back to the player working. And I say, like, all the best players have worked on their own away from a coach to get better. Yep. Like Kyrie Irving didn't learn how to make his layups because a coach stood there and said, hey, listen, move your finger like this and it'll spin off the backboard like this. Like, I wish I had that talent to tell someone that, but you know, he just figured it out, like you said, in those moments. So I do hope.
Can I share a Kyrie Irving story with you?
Yeah.
So I'm at George Mason. And because we recruited him at Georgia Tech, obviously unsuccessfully, yeah. But I got to know him a little bit. So when I got to George Mason, there was a kid on his team, Paris Bennett, who actually played with Kyrie at St. Pat's in New Jersey. And he said that, like, when they would play pickup, if Kyrie was waiting to get on the court, so, you know, the guys are playing pickup. He said, on one end of the court, you see Kyrie on down there practicing all these crazy looking layups. And we used to make fun of him, he said. He said, then all of a sudden, because he was ineligible his first year that he went to St. Pat's, played for Kevin Boyle, who's now at Montverde Academy in Florida.
Yeah.
But he said, like, we used to make fun. He goes, and then he got in the game. And he goes, all of a sudden, all those crazy layups that he used to practice, they were like, oh, there's a method to the madness here. So
I just, like, I look at someone like that, and you can equate it to soccer with a Lionel Messi or someone. You just know that the first thing they've done is ball mastery. Right? They've learned how to manipulate and be incredibly comfortable with the ball. And that's where I think that as coaches, that somehow if we can empower players to play more one-on-one on their own, that they develop more of that ball mastery, because look, you better develop or you're not going to ever succeed in one-on-one. And, you know, and that's something that I believed in, and hopefully at our youth level, maybe Coach Raveling will add that to the agenda, but I believe at the youth level, 3-on-3 and one-on-one, because one-on-one gives a player a chance to really, really try and figure out if they can come up with a solution, because there's no other option. So that's great stuff. Coach, let's get into the draft process, because this has stuck with me the last 2 years. And I go to the Florida Clinic and I don't know a lot of these things, that certainly from the NCAA, NBA perspective as much. And you've shed such a light on my eyes about different things. And the number one thing is the difference between the draft process in hockey and basketball. And I believe the other one was baseball. And why there's this different exists. Can you talk about that and educate us as fans and coaches a little bit about some of the things that the NCAA does?
Well, one of the things that really frustrates you about the NCAA is that, to me, they don't promote the game in a positive light. Being in the NBA now, going to my third year, the NBA does their very best to show the best of the game. And I don't mean, you know, the dunks and the buzzer beaters, but I'm talking about who these young men are as people and what they're doing with their lives. And I think too often the NCAA, they take this role, we are the parents, and we know what's best for these kids, and we'll tell them when it's time to go pro, and we'll tell them, you know, how much they should value a college education. And my thing is, it's put college basketball in a really bad light. The kids are often criticized for making poor decisions of when they enter the NBA draft. And what got me is thinking about, well, why don't we hear these stories in hockey and baseball? Because I'm a huge sports fan. I grew up watching the Islanders win 4 Stanley Cups. I'm a huge Yankee fan, even though today I'm in mourning because the Red Sox took us out. But, yeah. You know, what you find is that in hockey and baseball, those kids don't have to sign anything to give up their college eligibility in order to find out where they're going to get drafted. It's an age-eligible draft. In hockey, once you're 18 years old, between 18 and 20, you're in the draft automatically. You don't have to sign in. In baseball, you're automatically eligible to draft after your senior year in high school. You're also eligible for the draft after your freshman and junior colleges, if you choose, freshman and sophomore, you have junior college if you choose to. And then if you go to a four-year school, you're automatically eligible after your junior year. So for a hockey or a baseball player, there's no stress of, should I enter because they have nothing to lose. A basketball player, and I've gone through this with kids, Chris Bosh put his name in the draft early, Thaddeus Young put his name in the draft early, and there's a stress level that accompanies that because you don't know if you're going to get drafted, and here you are signing away your college scholarship, which is room, board, books, tuition, and fees. And so to me, the NCAA does a huge disservice to these kids because they don't give them the latitude to find out what they're worth before they have to decide to give up their college scholarship. Now, somebody listening may say, well, those aren't NCAA rules. Those are the Major League Baseball rules and the NHL Players Association rules. Well, the reality is it is an NCAA rule. I'm not saying that. I don't care what the NBA decides to do with their draft eligibility process, but the NCAA has complete latitude in allowing a kid to come back to school if they don't get drafted or if they don't like where they get drafted. In hockey, you have over 100, at least 100 NCAA hockey players who have their draft rights held by an NHL team right now. And in some cases, once the season's over, those kids will jump from the NCAA tournament once their team is eliminated right to an NHL ice. And I read about them every spring again, because I grew up, I don't watch it as much as I used to. I love watching playoff hockey, but I was an avid fan of the Nystrom, Tonelli, you know, Trottier, Bossy Islanders. Okay. So I know the game. I remember when I was working at a Roy Rogers in Old Country Road on Long Island, and Kenny Morrow, a defenseman who had gone from the 1980 Olympic team, joined the Islanders, and they ended up winning the Stanley Cup. So I know the game a little bit, but there are over 100 hockey players that are playing college hockey right now who have their draft rights held, and then they will go pro when the dollar amount is right, which is the way it's supposed to be for all of these kids. Basketball and football are the only two sports where the kids do not have the latitude to negotiate, find out what they're worth before they decide to give up their scholarship. I often hear about these kids make bad decisions. Well, the best way to change behavior is the marketplace. If you expose these kids completely to the marketplace, they find out what they're worth, then you'll see a shift back towards the value end of a college scholarship. It is not an accident that college hockey players, NCAA hockey has the highest graduation rate of the four revenue sports in NCAA, basketball, baseball, football, hockey. College hockey has the highest graduation rate. It's over 90% every year because these kids know that they're not going to get the money they thought they were going to get from the NHL. So now they better make sure they get that education. And when they do get the chance to go to the NHL, it's going to be for the dollar amount that they feel comfortable with to give up their scholarship.
Again, I sit back when I hear that and go, wow, like, why is it different for basketball and football? Like, this seems to be a no-brainer. Number one, because it would improve the college product, right? Like, I can't believe that wouldn't be in the interest of the NCAA and certainly NCAA coaches. But the other part is exactly what you said. A professional or a great student who's being recruited by any company in the world has these opportunities the same way. And why would we treat sport different? Well, because it's more visible? Is that why? Like, why do you think this is this way?
You know, Chris, it's a question I've really pondered and I've thought about. My mind takes me a lot of different places with it. I do believe, I think that on a certain level, we have the wrong people running college basketball and college football in the NCAA. I think there are people there who did not. They played sports. They played volleyball. They played softball. They played tennis or what have you. And they're bringing their experiences, they're bringing their perspectives to the sport, but they had no idea. They have no idea what goes on in the basketball world or the football world. I do think in baseball and hockey, particularly in baseball, the NCAA is afraid to get involved with blocking kids' right to find out what they're worth because I think they're afraid of going to court, quite honestly. There was a case back in 2010 or 11, Andrew Oliver, a left-handed pitcher for Oklahoma State, who the NCAA found out he had an agent, which everybody knows baseball players have agents, just like hockey players have agents. And it's a widely known secret. And so the NCAA decided to suspend him for 10 games. This young man took the NCAA to court, and he won a settlement, out-of-court settlement for $750,000. And the judge in the case basically told the NCAA, don't ever bring anything like this to my courthouse because this young man and his family deserve the right to have professional representation that can help him with a life-changing decision, such as giving up a scholarship and going to play pro sports. And so I don't know what it is. Again, I'm not going to hazard guess. Again, my mind wanders and it goes all over the place on it. But I do know one thing. It's patently unfair to put the pressure on football and basketball players that if you have any interest in finding out what you're worth, it's going to cost you something. It doesn't cost the other sports. Even golfers and tennis players, they have the ability to test out what they're worth on the pro tour or where they think they would rank on the pro tour before they give up their scholarship. But the limitations, the restrictions, the artificial economic barriers that are put in place in men's basketball and football, I just think are patently unfair and will be struck down in court whenever somebody has the funds to take them to court.
Well, and again, look, we're talking about very specific players. We're talking about a very specific part of NCAA football and basketball. But I equate this back, Coach, and I don't know if you know this, junior A hockey in Canada, a junior A hockey player, they guarantee that they'll pay for their education after their junior A career is done. So there's another way. Like, it's not just about paying players. Like, paying players may be the most obvious what people would think, but I'm like, there's other ways to do this. And it's like, if a player leaves college, but they've given, I don't know what it might be, 2 years, 3 years to the NCAA, then the NCAA should say, well, listen, we're going to pay for your education whenever you decide to come back. And that's basically what junior A model is. They want to guarantee.
You do have more and more colleges that are paying for scholarships to kids when they decide to go pro. But the thing that I find really unfortunate is the kid who puts his name in the draft because somebody told him, hey, you're going to get drafted. You can leave. I guarantee you. There's one situation, a young man I recruited. His mom told me the story. He went to another school. He was convinced by an agent and a shoe company rep, put your name in the draft. He puts his name in the draft. He goes down to Madison Square Garden, doesn't hear his name called. He tries to contact the agent and the shoe company rep. They never contact him. They wouldn't even take his phone call. And this happened about 10 years ago. And his mom told me, said she has never spoken to either one of those people since then. And so if he was a baseball player, if he was a hockey player, it would be no harm, no foul. He'd go back, get a scholarship. I was at a school I'm doing these trips now where I visit different colleges, an international player. Told his college coach, I'm leaving. I'm going back home. He goes home. He thinks he's going to get an offer from a team. He doesn't get the offer. He calls the school back and says, hey, coach, do you think I have my scholarship back? Well, because he was an international player and didn't make a big hullabaloo about him going pro, he was able to come back to his school and get his scholarship back and continue to play. But again, what I worry about are those kids who don't have that safety net in place. They don't have the ability to find out what their value is in the marketplace before they give up the scholarship. And now, for many of them, they're just out there doing nothing. Now, they can go back to school and continue with their college education. But it would be even better if they could go back to school, continue to play, hone their skills while they get their education. And then maybe there is a place for them in the NBA at some point or somewhere in professional basketball.
Again, I just think what you're saying sounds like a no-brainer to me, but I get that's not the way the world works, and certainly not when administration gets involved in different things.
No, the NCAA administration, it's really unfair. I mean, you know, again, if your listeners would love to look up, go on a site called College Hockey Inc. And basically, they have all the information about the latitude that college hockey players have, everything from having professional representation to, you know, the list of players, the hundreds of players who have their draft rights held, and how some of these kids, you know, their stories that, and as they should, they glorify these stories of these kids who are achieving a lifelong dream of playing NHL hockey for the sums of money that they have a chance to get. So it's just really, really unfortunate. And you and I talked about it in Florida. I'm so disappointed that the NBA is the only entity that promotes the game. And FIBA's starting to do that too. FIBA's starting to promote the game in a positive light. But in the United States of America, anytime you hear about NCAA men's college basketball, there's always something negative attached to it. If you hear about grassroots basketball, there's always something negative attached to it. And I think it's really felonious. It's a phony controversy, because if you look at the other youth sports, if you look at baseball, you look at volleyball, you look at soccer, all the things that we criticize in basketball, youth basketball, they play too much. You know, apparel and shoe companies, equipment companies are getting involved. They travel too much. And who's paying for their travel? All those stories that are said to be unethical and signs of corruption in basketball. Of course, it's everyday business in these other sports. And I'm not trying to point and say, well, you too, and well, they do it too. The reality is we should be trying to find the best practices and what works. And no one has ever said, well, okay, why don't we hear about these things in other sports? Well, the reason why we don't hear about them is because nobody talks about them, and it's no different from what goes on in basketball.
Yeah, and I'm going to give a shout out to coachspeak.net, which is Rob Lanier's site, who I know you know. And,
oh, yeah.
And in talking to him, he'll be a podcast guest at some point, but I love how he's approaching it, that he's trying to share positive stories in coaches' own words. Because I think you're right. Like, it's almost like coaches or, you know, players, which certainly they've done at the professional level through a lot of different mediums, players are starting to control their own stories at the professional level, where they share a lot of those stories that maybe the media don't find. And you're right. And coaches have a hard time because we don't like to talk about ourselves, you know, to a certain extent, because it's about the team and it's about our players. But man, I can tell you, having done this podcast, being around people like you and so many other coaches, it's amazing how many amazing things you do. Coach, one of the first things when I texted someone to ask, hey, what are some questions I should ask Paul? This may or may not be true, but it sounds true based on knowing you a little bit. But basically, at the beginning of their junior and senior years, and then at graduation, you would buy your manager suits out of your own pocket. Is that a true story?
You did some digging, man. You did some digging.
Coach.
Yeah, well,
I didn't have to dig far. I'm not going to lie. And that just struck me as going, man, doesn't that tell me something about you that you wouldn't talk about that probably yourself? You wouldn't share that story. But those are the things that you were talking about, that coaches do so many amazing things that are unnoticed.
Yeah.
But if you make one mistake, big or small, that's the one you're going to get known for.
The thing that's frustrating for me, Chris, is that people are just looking for a coach to make not even a mistake, but just it looks like a mistake, and they're just going to pounce. They see it. And again, the other thing that really bothers me, maybe so close to it, is I feel like the scrutiny is so heavy on basketball. And I'm sure the other sports have their issues. I don't follow the grassroots as closely, but I just think there's just so many amazing coaches out there that are doing so many positive things for their players. And I've been fortunate enough to meet guys like Larry Shyatt, obviously yourself, and just different guys out there, Frank Martin from South Carolina. You know, they're just great guys that are doing great things for their programs. Are coaches perfect? Absolutely not. I'm not perfect. None of us are perfect. But I would say the overwhelming majority of the guys in this profession, well, I don't care what level it is, are in it for the right reasons. And it's about trying to help young people to realize their potential or where they belong and find them a place in life where young people feel like they're productive and enjoying their lives.
And again, that's what it's all about. It's about helping people with future employability and obviously future success in life. And then being a model, and you said this at the beginning, being a model, whether it's a father, a parent, a person, and helping them become the same. And again, I've just so many people in this profession, and I love this profession, and I know you do too, that there's so many coaches doing such amazing things, and we definitely need to highlight them. So, Coach, maybe let's get just quickly some technical, tactical, or some basketball insights. And, you know, having shifted a little bit from college to the NBA, but what are some things that you think us as college coaches or high school coaches that we could be doing that they do better at the NBA? And I'm not talking about, you know, we could get into analytics and stuff like that, but let's, you know, things that we actually practically can do to be better, because sometimes it's resources, as you know, that the NBA has that we don't have. But are there anything that jumps out in your mind?
I just think about myself, and sometimes I would put kids in a box a little bit in games and just trying to restrict. And I don't think I did as much as some of the other coaches I looked around. I think there's so much pressure placed on coaches to win games. And so that leads us to restrict how much freedom we'll give a young man or what we'll work on with a young man. And so dribbling the basketball, being able to drive the ball and make a decision off the dribble is huge. Passing the basketball, understanding, you know, just simple numbers. If we got, you know, 3 versus 2 on our side of the court, 3 defenders and one's in the help, and we can shift at the other side of the court and we can get a 3-on-2 on the other side of the court, passing the basketball. And then the other thing to me is I don't think we work on shooting layups enough, quite honestly. Being able to finish in traffic or finish in transition, using the high part of the glass, just dribble, shoot, and pass. Those things are so basic And I think it's something that the NBA, that you spend a lot of time on, again, because of the spacing on the court and things like that. But even if you watch the international game, one of my best experiences as a person around this game is going to the EuroLeague Final Four in 2012 in Istanbul, Turkey, and just watching the ball movement and how much these guys move that basketball. And again, the players aren't as good as the NBA, and they definitely couldn't compete with the NBA. But the amount of ball movement, the amount of driving to set up the pass, I think we could do a better job as college coaches at all positions. And also teaching kids how they should limit their dribbles. I mean, I think 3 to 4 dribbles, once you get to that fourth dribble, if the help defense isn't there, guess what? You're going to beat that team anyway. But to beat the good teams, the teams that you got to beat to win that championship, win that league, get that top seed in your event or your tournament, it's going to be about being able to move the basketball, finish plays around the rim, and drive that ball to where you can get the help, draw the help, and so you can create numbers advantages for your teammate on the other side of the court.
No, that's good stuff. And I mean, that box and giving players a little bit more freedom, it's challenging, as you said, because ultimately, you know, you're evaluated based on wins and losses and not necessarily on the development of your players. I mean, you could develop all of your players and they'd be improving, but ultimately you're going to get judged based on that singular thing, which is, did you win more than you lose? And again,
yeah, but I tell you what, when you do spend time developing them and you get in the gym and again, some of the stuff that you do with the way you train them and try to get them to read and react to different cues that you put out there in your player development program, I tell you what, you're going to have a loyal kid for life. And certainly for that season, when they feel like you're teaching them, which is one of the reasons why I think if any success I had as a head coach, whether, and even as an assistant coach, going back to my, you know, Villanova days, or seeing as a head coach, any success I've had has been based on the fact that players felt like we were trying to help them to improve. And when you do that for them, then they're going to go out there. They're going to rebound a little harder. They're going to defend a little bit more. They're going to communicate a little bit better on the defensive end. All the selfless stuff, they're going to be more willing to do. And I think that the time that you spend in the gym with them on teaching them how to play, teaching them how to read and react in that one-on-one or two kids in the gym with you, I don't think you put a price tag on what it does for, you know, putting you, moving you towards success as a team.
That's great. Well said, Coach. And it's great to know that from that perspective, you know, you in retrospect as well would have done something a little bit differently. And that's by nature a coach, right? We're always going to review. We're always going to think we can do better. And we're always going to try and do better. And that's part of this process that I think is so unique. So, Coach, I don't know if you have any last thoughts to be able to share with coaches, but again, I really appreciate the message and what you shared and getting people to think a little bit deeper about some of these things that maybe we don't think about as much as coaches. But anything else you'd like to share?
I commend the guys out there that are in the coaching profession. Certainly, I'm partial to basketball, but you know, anybody out there spending their time working with young people, you're doing a great thing. And don't be afraid to speak up about it. Don't be afraid to puff your chest up about the work you're doing with the young people. And don't ever, when somebody starts to talk negatively about your sport, listen, if there's something wrong, speak up and make the changes. But if you feel like, you know, something's not being reported properly, if you feel like somebody doesn't understand that all the ramifications or how we got to a certain place that doesn't look good, explain it to people. Because you, like a lot of other people, when I start to explain to them the difference between the draft process and youth basketball and sponsorships and how equipment companies, you know, help out all kids throughout all sports, and they go, wow, I never realized that. It goes a long way to get people to think about the game in a proper light, as it should be, in a positive light.
Oh, that's wonderful. Great message, Coach. And you're a great ambassador for the game, and I know you'll continue to be. And you know, real happy that, I know the Clippers are fortunate to have you, but real happy that you're still involved in the game and speaking out on behalf of it and coaches. And I know you'll continue to do that. So thanks for joining us. And Coach, where can anyone follow you? I don't know if you're on social media or anything like that. Is there anywhere coaches can connect with you?
You know, I'm not. I mean, I try to get out and speak as much as I can. I do interviews, but I definitely, if anybody wants to contact me, they can reach me. My email address with the Clippers is phewitt@clippers.com. That's phewitt @clippers.com. If anybody's in questions for me, feel free to shoot me an email. I'd be more than happy to respond.
That's awesome. Thanks so much for sharing the game, Coach.
Thanks for having me on, Chris. Take care. Good luck with your season.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com.
That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.